Thanks to Rollbar for their longtime support of Does Not Compute. Every company has to deal with production errors sometimes. Finding and fixing live bugs can be a huge time sink, but Rollbar makes it quick and easy. Instead of digging through server logs to try and diagnose issues, and often not even finding out about issues until they affect large portions of your user base, Rollbar will automatically alert you when new issues come up. These alerts give you all the context you need to fix issues fast, like stack traces, request parameters, which users have been affected by an issue, and more. Rollbar hooks into just about every major language and framework in minutes, which means you can start tracking errors today. Even better, they play nice with the other tools you're probably already using, like Jira, GitHub, Trello, Slack, HipChat, Bitbucket, and lots more. To learn more and sign up for a free trial, head to rollbar.com/DNC. Our thanks once again to Rollbar for their continued support of the show, and make sure to check out rollbar.com/DNC today.
So what's the deal with virtual surround sound, Paul?
Virtual surround sound? Well, I know the Windows 10, that was out of left field. I like it. I know that Windows 10, the creator update, whatever that thing is called. It was a recent Windows 10 update that shipped with a bunch of stuff, and it has a bunch of new surround sound options. There's a, I believe, a Microsoft one and then a Dolby one that ship with it. I don't understand. I'm not an audio engineer, obviously. I don't even edit this podcast, but, it basically just processes the sound and then acts as if there are multiple speakers, even though there aren't. And it can give a super realistic impression of sound location, but also sometimes it can sound echoey or kind of tinny. It really depends on like the audio source and the person listening and the headphones. And, sure. You know, with everything, there's a million variables, right?
Right. So I think it was last week, maybe. What is it? Earlier this week, maybe. I mentioned something about my PS4 Gold and using surround sound with PUBG, and you said you preferred stereo anyway. And so fast forward a few days, and my PS4 Golds are falling apart. Every time I put them on my head and I take them off, Jamie's like picking black pieces of fake leather off my face.
Oh, that's the worst.
They're just falling apart. I had them for a long time. And so I went and got some new headphones, and I ended up getting the Arcus 7s by, hold on, let me look. SteelSeries, I think, is the brand name, SteelSeries Arcus 7. And they have, like, the part of the marketing was surround sound and all that stuff, 7.1. And I'd never owned a pair of, like, fancy PC gaming headset. I guess this could be used with a PS4 and Xbox as well, but I've never owned like a nice pair before. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to hear all the snipers now in PUBG. And I turned surround sound on and then immediately turned it off. It sounded not good.
Yeah. I've never had super great luck with it. I tried, I wish I could remember the name of the Windows one, but I tried that one as well as the Dolby one, which is like a paid add-on, but they have a trial of it. And neither of them were for me. I find that the stereo, at least in games like PUBG, works super well for me in terms of locating things. The harder part in that game in particular is that it does so much, they're doing so much modeling with the bullet sounds that it sounds very different to what you might be used to in other like shooting games.
Sure.
So like as the bullet flies past you, if it's supersonic, you actually hear a crack before you hear the gunshot. So you'll hear that like in a different ear than where you actually hear the gunshot coming from. And that throws a lot of people off, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, I won my first solo ever earlier today. And it was kind of like that because, you know, everyone's snaking. Everyone's crawling around in the grass because the zone is small enough. And I'm hearing crawling, but I can't actually tell in which direction people are. And it made it super stressful. But I don't know. I went back to stereo. And I like the headphones. They feel nice and they sound good and all that. But I don't know. What's funny is that there seems to be so much marketing behind it and so much money being put in. Like, buy our virtual surround sound. You can hear everything around you. When really it sounds like I put a fishbowl on and I poke some holes in it in certain directions. Yeah. And It doesn't sound great.
Well, I mean, we only have two ears. Like, there's only two inputs, so it kind of doesn't. When you're that close to the head, it's just not going to make that big of a difference, anyhow.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, it's just not going to be the same. I don't know. It just didn't sound very great. But I mean, so we've talked about this bullet stuff a few times when we're hiding, we're both hiding from other people. And we talk about how like tools, like a good tool is worth so much. And we, you know, talk, like I was talking to you earlier about how much I'm enjoying Nuxt, and it's making, so I'm cleaning up a lot of the Knight Foundation stuff that was kind of like hacked together to make it work. There's lots of edge cases that were non-standard route setups, basically. And so when I'm porting things over to Nuxt, it's working out pretty well because it's super easy to extend the routes. And so in talking, like hearing about like the bullet sounds and like just the how many variables there must be involved in that, you said that. So I know that PUBG is using Unreal, and I've never used Unreal Engine. I've never really even used Unity for that matter. But it's just crazy to me, like how good these engines are and how much a lot of these developers get for free just by picking a tool like that.
Yeah, it's incredible, man. Literally, I also can't speak for Unreal, but in Unity, to make a sound appear from a certain spot, you actually just literally put it in the world in that spot, and it does all the calculations for you for how that sound needs to appear for whatever given audio listeners are also in the scene. And it all just works based on their actual physical in-game locations, which is super cool and really empowering as a developer. Like, it gives you the ability to go in and model more complex stuff and do more interesting things without having to reinvent the wheel with all that basic stuff again.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's really interesting to me. It's something I've never really dealt with. Though just even trying to solve any problem like that, I wouldn't know where to start. Like, I'm not a physicist that works in anything to do with physical space. So I wouldn't know how to solve that problem. It's just crazy that we have access to tools. I was thinking about the AR stuff too. You know, iOS 11 is out now, and we're starting to see more AR apps like measuring tapes. And obviously another big application is like interior design. You know, I've seen lots of people uploading videos of them putting furniture in their house, you know? And it's just crazy because so much work has gone into that technology, and we as developers just can use it. I mean, in Apple's case, you pay them $100 a year, and then you can use any of that toolkit stuff that they put out for AR and machine learning, which is crazy to me because think of how many person hours went into that work, went into that research, went into that redoing things. And then me as a developer, I can read a couple of docs, and I can type a few lines of code, and then I'm just using all of that. It's pretty wild.
Right. And especially stuff with machine learning models that are provided as services. Which Apple is doing now, and obviously Google does a fair bit of, and Amazon. All the major players are working on this to some extent, right? But what's really incredible to me is that that's something that you just can't really build on your own. And I love that it just gives you access to a complete set of tools that you otherwise wouldn't be able to recreate, just because it's so much data and so much stuff that goes into training these models, right? And
right.
I think that's so awesome, and I love that all these tools are coming out to help people. I also am just a super fan of the fact that Apple is being so blatant about how big and important AR is going to be, how soon. Like, yeah, think about before the iPhone came out, there's that famous Steve Jobs interview or whatever. He's like, oh, we never work on a phone. Phones are ridiculous. Phones are for idiots or whatever. Cause mm-hmm. In his Steve Jobsian kind of way, right?
Right.
And then a couple years later, they dropped the iPhone and it changed the entire world. But with AR, they're actually out there saying, okay, this technology is in its infancy, but it's going to be really important. Like, the fact that they're talking about it so much and so publicly this early on means that they know just how big of a thing AR is going to be. And I'm getting real, real excited about AR, Sean. Real excited.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. So another thing was, I was talking to my parents this morning, and they're both learning Swift. And I'm helping my mom build an iOS app. She came up with the idea all by herself. Not to mean, like, I say it and it sounds weird when I say it that way, but like, it's her idea, you know. It's something that she could use every day to make her life better. And so she was like, I want to build an app. And I was like, that mm-hmm. sounds awesome. And so she's learning Swift, and my dad's learning Swift. And I was just talking to them this morning about that, like all the different toolkits they provide that you can just use and have access to. Because my dad has mentioned to me a couple of times in the past an app idea that could be really useful for him and his job. And That was before. So like what he was talking about would specifically pull on the machine learning toolkits that they have. And he was mentioning to me before they had machine learning toolkits. And I was like, hey, that exists. Either it takes a long time to figure out TensorFlow and you have to train your models, or you pay someone lots of money, like Clarify, and then you have access to it, right? But even then you have to work with them to train the model. And then you're at their mercy in which whether or not they decide if the model is useful, basically.
It's not a weekend project at that point.
It's not a weekend project, no. And it still really isn't necessarily a weekend project, but man, they like it's not what it was, that's for sure. And so, yeah, I was just talking to them this morning, like how maybe like good we have it isn't the right term, but how many tools, like advanced tools are at our disposal now is pretty wild.
Yeah, yeah, it's really... I don't want to say a democratization because it's all controlled by companies, but it feels like a democratization of you don't necessarily need a big team to build big stuff anymore, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Because the heavy lifting is done by other teams and then you can just use that. I think that's a pretty fair thing to say. It's more like commoditization, right? Like we said, Google, Amazon, Apple, et cetera, many other players as well are kind of throwing their hats in the ring with like, hey, you pay us a little bit of money and then you can have your own machine learning model. It's just so much more prevalent. I think maybe commoditization is the term I might use there for that, but it's just wild. I don't know. It's just something I've been thinking about this week too, because in both DK and Watch Nature, I'm starting to get more into features where I've never really built them before, and especially around features where data coming from the server is heavily based off of the current user and the current user's context. So the app is actually going to be quite different for cross user to user. Sure. And that's a pretty common thing, you know, in most apps, especially social-ish apps, but it's something I've never built before. So I've been doing a lot of heavy lifting and upskilling in that realm, like learning how people structure those things, learning how to do it efficiently, like, you know, making sure data is preloaded and I'm not like just having queries being added to the pipeline everywhere. So it's one of those weeks where I'm thankful that other people have done hard work and they're just kind of throwing their knowledge out there. And I feel like a phony is the wrong term, because like I am doing the work and I'm doing the learning, a lot of learning myself too, but I'm not doing as much work as I would have needed to several years ago.
I like that we started and finished this podcast with the exact same amount of imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
We're almost at episode 100. What? And this is 199, yeah, right?
Today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I was thinking about this morning too. I don't know that I wanted to talk about it more on 100 because it's the 100th episode, but I was thinking about exactly that same thing. I was thinking like, what was I doing when we first started the show? Like I was recording, I was suspending a Yeti microphone from a coat hanger in a closet.
We were both in closets at the start, right?
Right.
It's the only, and I was, only rooms we had.
Just started using Vue maybe. I think I just started learning about Vue and learning about like reactive UIs. And I think I had just maybe finished like my second Rails app or second app ever. I think like it was shortly after that or maybe a few months after that. I don't know. It feels like not that long ago, but it feels like a very long time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while. I mean, it's been like 2 years. A lot can change in 2 years for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about that.
I wonder what tech is going to look like. What is JavaScript going to look like in late 2019, man? It's going to be crazy.
I'll be a back-end developer by then. I'll have shed the front-end exterior. I don't know. I don't like, I say that like, okay, so I've been doing a lot of back-end work and I do like it a lot. And then I switched to front-end work and I enjoy it, but it's not because of JavaScript that I enjoy it. I like seeing the project come together. And I think that was maybe the biggest change I've noticed in myself since we started the show was when we first started the show, I was into the technologies that I was using and not so much into what I was using to build or using them to build, if that makes sense. I was more focused in learning the intricacies of what I was using. And fast forward 2 years, and granted, I've been using, I mean, Elixir's new-ish, but I feel pretty productive in it. I don't feel like anytime I want to do something, I have to stop and Google because I'm past that point now, which feels pretty good.
But I mean, you pretty quickly got to a point with Elixir where you seemed just as comfortable as you ever seemed in Rails.
Right. And what's funny is that I've had to go back and work on the Rails app periodically. And I'm like, I don't know what am I doing? So it's just, yeah, it's strange how fast it clicked for me. But the difference is I picked up Elixir because I knew that it would build the things that I wanted to build. I would be able to build a better product. And I'm not saying anything about Rails. I'm not trying to knock it down.
No, but for what you were trying to build and for how it fits with your brain. I think that's a really important thing too, that people don't often talk about, is that like some people are just better suited to different programming languages. They just work better in their mind. And that's completely okay, but you have to mess around with different languages to find which ones really suit you as an individual.
Right. But even with Elixir, like obviously I'm interested in it as technology, but I don't spend all my time looking at Elixir itself. I'm looking more at like design patterns. How do you structure databases to do a certain thing? How would you structure queries to do a certain thing? How would you have these different systems work together? And it's not so much like, okay, what I'm trying to say makes sense. Like, I'm not obsessed with Elixir. I'm using Elixir to build something. And it just so happens that Elixir was a better tool for me than Ruby was at the time. Whereas when we first started the show, I was 100% focused on Ruby and Vue because I liked Ruby and Vue.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I think I get what you're saying. I mean, I guess sort of a corollary to that would be when I go to design out a feature, and I don't mean like necessarily pixel design, but like figure out how a feature should work, I don't really do that. Like in Ruby, I start writing like paragraphs of words, or at least like bullet points of words, and just saying, okay, this thing needs to connect to this thing and talk to this thing because of these reasons to accomplish this task. And then I figure out how to turn that into code. Like for me, that's a simpler part. And the architecture, I spend more and more time on that. And we've covered this in the past before, of course, but
sure.
I think that's such an important thing. Like as I've improved as a developer, the language is really secondary a lot of times. It's more about like what I'm trying to achieve and what that's going to imply for users and how people use the application and how people interact with the application.
So it just clicked in my head, right? What I'm trying to say is over the past 2 years, I've become a better developer. And so now I don't need to focus on syntax as much. And now I can focus on actually building things, and syntax takes the backseat. And so what I didn't know was that I needed to focus on syntax so much before. I thought it was just because I was really interested in the language. But really, it was because I didn't know enough about programming that's not what I should be focusing on. I should be focusing on the other side of it and using that language and that tool. And I think that's where the transition happened. Was I just have more experience. And then that, it was just funny that when you were talking, it clicked in my mind. I was like, that's probably why.
All right, man. We talked a little bit about AR and we kind of got away from it. I want to talk some more about AR. I'm so excited about it, man. I'm so excited. It's going to be amazing. And I think here's the thing. People see these ridiculous demos at the Apple keynotes. I'm sorry, Apple. I know you're very offended, but they see these ridiculous demos of people like holding up iPads and looking at a table or whatever. And then people are like, okay, well, I don't really care about that. Why do I want to do that on my phone? I don't. And I agree with you. Here's the thing. We're only a couple of years out from that actually not being on a phone anymore. Like I think a lot closer than many people think. I'm guessing 2021, 2022, Apple is going to have a consumer electronics device on the market that is what we would think of right now as like true AR, where you actually interact with things in physical space and you just wear it and it is there in the world constantly or near constantly.
What's that movie? Minority Report. That's what everyone uses as like the quintessential example, right? Minority Report. That scene where they have the gloves on and they're touching seemingly nothing, but they're interacting with the UI.
Right. Yeah. Similar stuff to that. Portable, wearable, and like actually socially acceptable and useful. And why they're pushing it so hard right now, I believe at least, and many other people believe, why they're pushing it so hard right now isn't because they think it's a great experience on the phones, but rather because people need to get used to interacting with AR and developers need to figure out how to build great AR experiences. Because they just, like, it's a new thing. And Apple knows they've built, you know, some of the most successful products in the world that have changed industry after industry. And Apple knows how to do this sort of thing. And in this particular case, you really need to give devs lead time, and you need to give people lead time so that when you release the glasses or whatever that is called, right? Whatever the all day, every day kind of device actually is, where you're just looking at the world through augmented reality. People need to be acclimated to that because, I mean, obviously there's going to be, you can imagine all the stories that are going to come out, just like with Face ID and Touch ID and everything, like everything Apple does, security related or like that could be considered invasive.
Yeah, no, I think you're completely right. I think that obviously the phone isn't the end medium that it's going to be used on. And I think the big part, we need developer cycles on thinking about how to work with AR, how to develop for AR. You know, Apple's doing all their research, putting up the Higgs and all that stuff. And that's great. There also needs to be that cycle with people, like you said, because a lot of people are Face ID, I'll never do that. Or Touch ID, I'll never do that. You know what I mean? Like, oh, people are just collecting your thumbprints and now they'll be collecting your faces and all that stuff. And while I think it's good for the public, I think it's necessary for that kind of feedback cycle where, you know, someone comes out with an innovation and they put it out there and everyone's like, we don't like this and here's why. And then not that the person that, like, say, not that Apple has to like justify everything they're doing. It's just more like that feedback loop of like, okay, well, here's how we can dispel some of those sentiments, right? And then it's just a cycle because they'll put out the next thing. People will say, there's no way this could be secure. There's no way this and that. And I think that cycle is necessary. And it is interesting reading the news and like looking at the Face ID. It's funny because people are almost literally saying the same thing. There's just two different sentiments coming from behind it. Like you can see a tweet and it would say, oh, great, Apple knows what my face is now. And some people are happy because now they don't, you know, they're looking at their phone already. And then some people are like, oh, great, Apple knows what my face looks like now. And they mean that in the sense of like, they shouldn't, it's like a breach of privacy, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think the feedback cycles are important. And it's, what's interesting to me is watching people just get caught up in those cycles. Like they can't see beyond what's happening currently. And a lot of that happens in the design world. Because anytime Apple will change like the border radius of a circle or a squircle or whatever you want to call it, people just go nuts. You know what I mean? And that's fine. Yeah. Like that's okay for them to do that. I don't get offended by it anymore. I used to just be like frustrated by that, but now I could care less. But I think all that stuff is important. And that's just part of one thing that entertains me is watching all the different reactions and trying to analyze like why this person's reacting that way.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. People respond to technology in very interesting ways. And a lot of times I think their stated reasons, like, oh, I'm worried about privacy or I'm worried about security, are actually more like I'm worried about change and I'm worried about new things.
Sure. Right.
Which is a very normal, like that's a human thing. Evolutionarily, it makes sense. It is good, but it's also like when you're trying to introduce a new technology like this, you really do have to start from the ground floor and be like, hey, here's this idea that's out in the world now. People become aware of it and get used to that idea being in the world.
Well, it's almost like being a salesman trying to sell anybody something new. So especially a tool that someone uses every day, because everyone that has a phone uses it pretty much every day. That's pretty much true. I mean, there's probably people that don't, but for the most part, people that have like an iPhone will use it every single day, multiple times a day. And so, for example, if you make carpentry tools and you roll to a bunch of carpenters and show them something they've never seen before, of course, they're going to be skeptical. They're going to say, like, why? How does this help me? What about this situation? What about that situation? Because it's something they use every day. It's something that's very close to them. And they use it to make a living. They use it to, especially phones, you know, people, it's like their lives. They have their photos on it. Their media is on it. Everything's on it. So as soon as you show something different, of course, there's going to be all those questions. People are just going to question it. It's just interesting because especially with Apple devices, with phones and watches or whatever, a lot of people use them for both work and personal reasons. And I think that's maybe why there's such a strong reaction, right? Because a change to something could affect their bottom line. It could affect their ability to be productive, but also it affects the things that are personal to them, especially like, for example, changes with the Photos app. You know, people have their whole lives in photos and videos on their phones, and they, rightfully so, are worried when things just change without notice.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, and like it really, a lot of times, does come down to people being afraid of change, or people not liking change, or people being concerned about change. It's such a big thing, when introducing new tech. So I mentioned I had that 2021, 2022 estimate, and some people are probably wondering where I got that from. I think it's pretty realistic. There's actually a super good article I read the other day, though. I was trying to pull it up and find out who the author was, but we'll get it in show notes. Super good stuff. This guy actually walks through basically where this technology is now, how it works on a technical level, but enough so that a layperson can understand. Like it's really broken out very nicely, and then talks about what needs to change from where we are currently to get to what we would consider like true AR as readers in 2017, where you're wearing glasses and you see things on the wall and you can interact with things in 3D with your hands. Right. And he actually talks about like, here's where the tech is now, here's where it needs to be, and here are the steps and how long those are probably going to take based on, and the guy's been working in AR for like a decade or something. It's really cool though. And I highly recommend anybody who's interested in AR goes to check that out. It's very cool stuff. I'm so excited.
I'm very interested in that. I would like to read it.
It's going to be like a light switch. The world is going to just overnight be a different world.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not close enough to space to even begin to think about what the application might even look like. You know, I've only ever seen like movies, right? And I've only seen what we have now, which is mainly measuring and putting photos or putting things in, on tables or putting chairs in your house and blowing them up. I can't remember what app it was, but you can do something like that. It's just interesting. I would like to read more about it and think about what more actual practical use cases would be. I've seen obviously like photo identification and stuff like that, and that's also fine, but I don't know. It's just one of those things I've been interested in. I've been talking about wanting to get into game development a little bit, just kind of dabble my feet in and get into VR and stuff like that. So I don't know. I mean, there's so many, especially as a creator or as like a programmer, someone that's has a skill set to be able to learn things quickly. Just because, like I feel like I could pick up Unity a lot quicker than the average person could, just because I've been in a similar space, right? I think there's so many tools that, like, why would I not take advantage of that?
That was kind of that's why I've started doing VR dev, and I'm going to be getting into AR as soon as I can, is just because it's like I have this thing and I have the skills to make something for it. So I feel almost compelled. Like it's almost like not optional, right?
Right.
Because it would just be a waste otherwise. And AR is even more exciting to me because, I mean, when you think about it, AR, like virtual reality, is actually just an app inside of really good AR glasses. Mm-hmm. It's just a subset. Like AR is everything, and then VR is just when the glasses are fully on eventually. Mm-hmm. Like once we have that tech, that's what it's going to be. Is like to do VR stuff, you just launch an app from inside your AR headset or glasses or whatever this device is.
Right.
Pretty cool stuff.
It is pretty cool stuff, man. Now I have to go back to making web apps. Databases and WebSockets and such, you know.
This episode of Does Not Compute was brought to you by Rollbar. Rollbar makes finding and fixing production errors quick and painless. When something goes wrong, they'll send you an alert with stack traces, request parameters, affected users, and more. Of course, Rollbar also hooks into tons of other tools, so you can be notified in Slack, have automatic GitHub or Trello issues created, and more. Take a look at rollbar.com/DNC to learn more and sign up for a free trial.